Welcome to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel, and I'm joined by MNN's Bill Werner, Brent Palm, and Mike Grimm. We're going to delve into what's happening in the North Star State. If it matters in Minnesota, we've got it covered. This week, what you need to know about lung cancer. What's behind the decline of the moose population in Northeast Minnesota? The U of M volleyball team opens its season, but first. The State Fair means a new school year is nearly here, and there was significant development on that front this week that are reverberating on Minnesota's political scene. MNN's Bill Werner is here with that and other going-ons at the state capitol.
Tasha, this week the State Education Department released statewide test results from 2023, and there's no getting around that they are far from sterling. Just over half of students tested are not reading at grade level in Minnesota, slightly more than last year. In math, about 55% did not reach grade level standards. That's slightly fewer than last year. In science, 61% fell short. That's a 2% increase from last year. House Republicans point person on education, Little Falls Representative Ron Crenshaw, says the lack of forward progress is not surprising and very disturbing, he says.
We put forward a focus on the science of reading, huge investment proposals that would have moved this forward. The Democrats chose large mandates, more bureaucracy, and I think it's really going to weigh our student scores down even further.
Republican Senator Zach Duckworth from Lakeville says,
we're shooting ourselves in the foot when we pass something like the READ Act, and then we pass a whole host of other requirements and mandates, because really what we're telling folks is, hey, we're going to put this program in place, but it's going to be maybe second, third, fourth order in the list of priorities.
Democratic Senator Mary Kunish from New Brighton responds she does not see those other measures as mandates.
The amount of money that we put in towards mental health, $45 million in new library aid programs, I think that's a really important investment.
Republicans say instead of Democrats' mandates on school districts, laser focus on academics is necessary to improve Minnesota's students' poor test scores in reading, math, and science.
Make that a priority. Push everything else to the side. Every other good idea that might be out there, every other additional mandate or distraction, let's focus on our literacy rates, our math proficiency rates.
Contends Republican Senator Duckworth, but Democratic Senator Kunish says she's very proud of money the legislature put toward English learner programs, special education, and transportation subsidies, among other programs.
That freed up millions of dollars for our school districts to not only incorporate some of the things that we ask them to do, but also to address the needs that are unique and specific to their own school districts.
And this week, Moorhead became the focal point in a statewide debate over a new law that restricts law enforcement's use of prone and compression restraint techniques on students during altercations at school. The Moorhead Police Department announced it's pulling its resource officers from school buildings over fears of possible lawsuits. Police Chief Shannon Monroe contends the new statute takes away an officer's authority to intervene except when a person is physically harming someone else.
So they can't do anything that's preventing that. Like if you start to see a fight or argument, there would be no way to actually physically restrain and separate people.
State Education Commissioner Willie Jett asked Attorney General Keith Ellison for a legal opinion. Ellison writing back that, quote, the legislature expressed its clear intent to not limit the use of reasonable force when faced with the threat of bodily harm or death. But Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association Executive Director Jeff Potts indicated that despite that legal opinion, they, quote, still aren't confident the new law will allow law enforcement to keep students and staff members safe. Problems with medical billing and health care access. The focus this week in St. Paul at the first of two public hearings hosted by Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, a second listening session next month in Rochester. Prompting Ellison's investigation, he says reports of
aggressive hospital billing, unfair collection practices, denial of care when there is an outstanding bill. People are being sued for outstanding bills who have qualified for charity care.
Monica Wernette told Ellison she found out a year after a motor vehicle accident that none of her medical bills had been promptly submitted to the auto insurer, and a collection agency said unless she paid $5,000 in 30 days, she could no longer see her medical provider.
It costs people their livelihood to be in that type of situation where you're with chronic pain, that you need medication if you need a provider in order to survive.
Attorney General Ellison says those who could not attend this week's session and can't go to next month's hearing in Rochester can tell their stories using an online form at the Minnesota Attorney General's website. Governor Tim Walz this week named a successor to Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Lori Gilday, who's stepping down after leading the high court for 13 years. The governor's choice? Associate Justice Natalie Hudson.
The fact that I am the first person of color and the first black person to be the Chief Justice of the state of Minnesota is, of course, not lost on me. And I'm deeply humbled and honored by this recognition.
And to take the Associate Justice position formerly held by Hudson, the governor appointed his former staff lawyer, Carl Procaccini. House Republican Minority Leader Lisa Damoth said Walz, quote, picked the chief architect of the 2020 lockdowns and mandates that destroyed businesses and kept our kids out of the classroom. A person, she says, quote, with zero judicial experience to serve on the state's highest court. Hamline University political and legal analyst David Schultz points out six of the seven justices on the Minnesota Supreme Court have now been appointed by Democratic governors, with the one remaining Republican appointee, G. Barry Anderson, facing mandatory retirement next year, meaning Governor Walz will be able to appoint his replacement.
This changes it from a trifecta to a quadrifecta. The governor or the executive branch, as well as both houses of the legislature and the state Supreme Court, are all controlled by the same party. You would hope that the justices would be impartial, that justice is supposed to be blind. But unfortunately, that's not the case anymore. If we look at the U.S. Supreme Court, the best predictor of how justices vote is to look at whether they're appointed by a Democrat or Republican president. Go over to Wisconsin. We've got a partisanly divided court over there. And across the country, we're increasingly seeing evidence that party and ideology matters. And this could be an issue, a big issue going forward in Minnesota.
Hamline University's David Schultz. Tasha?
Thanks, Bill. More Minnesota Matters after this.
It's Thursday night and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. The Breath of Hope Lung Foundation is encouraging eligible Minnesotans to get screened for lung cancer. Joining me today is the organization's executive director, Nancy Torreson.
First of all, can you tell us a little bit about your organization and the mission behind it?
A Breath of Hope Lung Foundation was founded in 2008 by patients that had met, lung cancer patients that had met at a lung cancer support group. And they started with just an event, a 5K. They called it the Breath of Hope Lung Run Walk, and that was started even before they incorporated. And then a couple of years later, they developed programming and hired staff and things like that. So we've been operational since 2008, which basically makes this year our 15th birthday.
You know, and speaking of that 23%, my mom has lung cancer and was diagnosed. And she's still with us. She's one of the lucky ones that treatment has helped. But I know when she was originally diagnosed these years ago, lung cancer was one of the most underfunded research cancers out there. Does that still hold true?
Yeah, so I guess that is why we have to fund research as a private organization. So, you know, I guess the way to look at it is when you look at the research funding that goes out through the U.S. from the government and from other sources to lung cancer per cancer deaths, lung cancer is greatly underfunded. So, for instance, and some of these stats are old because you don't get the most current stats, but for instance, a couple of years ago, the funding per cancer death in breast cancer was 10 times higher than the funding to research in lung cancer. And meanwhile, lung cancer has a 23% survival rate. The breast cancer survival rate is over 90%, and twice as many women die of lung cancer every year as breast cancer. So the funding per cancer death is lower for lung cancer, and we consider that a disparity.
You know, let's talk a little bit about, are there any typical age groups where we're seeing lung cancer affecting, or any specific groups, I guess?
Yeah, so I think there's different ways to look at the groups that are affected by lung cancer, but it's really, really important to note that both non-smokers and smokers get lung cancer. So while we are only able to screen smokers right now, or former smokers, that's all that our country will allow for eligibility, we're also constantly educating non-smokers, because we know that non-smokers and never smokers also get lung cancer. So age groups and ethnicities, I think that's another thing to be very aware of. So we know that more than half of the diagnoses happen in low-income communities. We know that certain ethnic groups have higher incidence and mortality rates, such as Black men. It's in America, Black men in America, it's their number one cause of death, whereas for Caucasians, lung cancer is number two cause of death after heart disease. For almost everybody, lung cancer is the number one cause of cancer death. So those ethnic groups, Native Americans are another group that are affected higher in terms of incidence and in mortality. So those are groups that we reach out to and try to work with. But also age-wise, we've seen an uptick in cases among younger women, 30s, 40s, and 50s, smokers and non-smokers. So that's something that's kind of a trend, at the same time as, you know, cancer diagnoses are dropping, you know, nationwide. So that's a concern. And at A Breath of Hope Lung Foundation, we meet a lot of those women, and a lot of them are never smokers, and they're in their 40s. And they typically are diagnosed with a stage 4 lung cancer diagnosis, which is terminal. We do see, I think it's 74% right now in the U.S., 74% of lung cancer cases are diagnosed in stage 3 or 4. And so that's a really, really big problem for this cancer. And the rest of the problem is that eligibility for preventative screening is pretty limited. So unless you're over the age of 50 and have a significant smoking history, you are not eligible to be screened, and you can't just march in and request it and ask to pay for it, because that's not allowed. So we are not allowing, you know, the general population to be screened for lung cancer. And of the people that are eligible in Minnesota, less than 8% have been screened. And of the people that are eligible to be screened nationwide, less than 6% have been screened. So we have so many different problems going on at the same time. For one thing, the eligibility criteria is very limited. And for another thing, the people that are eligible are not getting screened. So all of those things are things that A Breath of Hope Lung Foundation is working on across the country, but very specifically right now in Minnesota through screening campaigns.
And I understand you folks are going to be out at the Great Minnesota Get-Together, the State Fair. Can you tell us a little bit about your booth exhibit?
Yes, we're very excited. A Breath of Hope is collaborating with Mayo and the University of Minnesota and Regions and Allina and a couple other healthcare systems to exhibit at the State Fair in the Care 11 health booth, or health tent, I guess it's called. And we'll be there driving people to minscreens.org, which is a screening campaign that A Breath of Hope is holding across the state of Minnesota at the same time as the State Fair. So we've got the Great Minnesota Get Together, which is the State Fair. We'll be there in the Care 11 health tent. And then meanwhile, we've got the Great Minnesota Screen Together, which is an advertising campaign that is set up to reach 6 to 8 million Minnesotans in the next 2 weeks with messaging about lung cancer screening and messaging about eligibility quizzes and things like that.
Thanks again to my guest, Nancy Torson, Executive Director of the Breath of Hope Lung Foundation here in Minnesota. Time for a quick break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. A new study confirms what scientists suspected was to blame for a decline in the moose population in northeast Minnesota. On this week's show, MNN's Brent Palm talks with a U of M researcher about the new evidence recently published in the Journal of Wildlife Diseases.
Tyler Garwood, University of Minnesota researcher. From what I understand, a new study suggests a big decline in the moose population of northeastern Minnesota many years ago. And you folks have determined at least a reason for that drop. Tyler, tell us a little bit about this study that you guys did with the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
Yeah, so this civic study was actually more focused on trying to understand the transmission cycle of brainworm. But yeah, previously, there had been some work done both by the Minnesota DNR and by the Grand Portage Band that was showing that among adult moose, brainworm or meningeal worm or Paralaphus strongylus tenuis was an important cause of decline, so a really important source of mortality. And so because of that finding, our lab, led by Dr. Tiffany Wolf, decided to try to learn a little bit more about brainworm's ecology. And it's got this fairly complicated transmission cycle, whereby it's basically a co-evolved with deer. So it's asymptomatic in deer, and about 60% of them carry it. And then they'll shed the brainworm larvae into the environment through their feces. And then for the transmission cycle to continue, a slug or snail intermediate host needs to move across those infected feces. And then that infected slug or snail then needs to be eaten by a deer for the cycle to continue. This will usually happen when they're like browsing on vegetation. However, with more deer moving into northern Minnesota, we're seeing more aberrant transmission to moose. And so moose are basically eating those slugs and snails that are infected more often. And in moose, it causes pretty severe neurological symptoms. And so we know a lot about white-tailed deer and their ecology. They're pretty well-studied species. But we understand a lot less about those slug or snail intermediate hosts. And if you think about it, that's a really hard interaction to observe. You know, you can't really look through binoculars and identify which slugs or snails moose are eating. But with these new DNA sequencing and molecular techniques, we can get a better idea of that interaction. So what we did was just collect a bunch of moose feces, and then we sequenced the DNA in those feces and used online databases to figure out which species of slugs or snails were present in those feces. And that gave us more of an idea of which of these intermediate hosts they were eating, which we're hoping then that information could be used in turn to look at which types of forest management treatments might reduce the number of those slugs or snails on the landscape, and therefore hopefully reduce transmission to moose.
Yeah, and to go back to kind of the lead line of that study, northeastern Minnesota had a 58% decline in its moose population between 2006 and 2017. So 15, 16 years ago up until 5 years ago.
Around maybe like 2015, we saw the decline kind of level out. But part of the problem is like the population hasn't recovered yet. So we're kind of at this new lower but stable population level. And so we're kind of looking for ways to, return that population to its previous levels.
I remember talking with either someone from the U or the DNR many years ago, and we suspected that there was some sort of brainworm that might be partly to blame for this population decline. And so this is some pretty awesome research, right?
Yeah, I think it's really cutting edge. I mean, it's the first time we've been able to actually observe that moose are probably being infected the way that we think they were. So we have our first empirical evidence that moose are eating gastropods or slugs or snails that are known to carry P. tenuis or brainworm. So for example, we detected this snail called Xanatoides arboreus. That's a well-known carrier of P. tenuis. And so it's really interesting in this rather, I guess, small study area sample, we actually detected them consuming this well-known carrier of P. tenuis. So it definitely fills an important knowledge gap in our understanding of this disease that definitely has conservation importance for moose in the state.
Yeah, you mentioned, so in the last 5 years, maybe a somewhat stable population. The last story we did last spring, I think the most recent aerial population was like 3,300, and it was more than 4,600 in 2022. So what number would be where you guys want to bring it back to?
Ideally, we would like to see the moose population return to a, what it previously was, so about 8,000 individuals. A big part of, I think, our mission is, with a lot of the research we're doing, is to try to maintain huntable populations of moose for the Superior Chippewa. We're partnering with the Grand Portage Band on this project, and it's really important to their their cultural heritage, and also it's part of their treaty rights to be able to hunt moose on the 1854 ceded territory. So really that's the main goal, is just trying to keep a huntable population of moose in northeastern Minnesota for as long as we can.
Wow. Well, Tyler Garwood from the U of M, thanks for the insight on the research. And, you know, like you said, this is, you know, one of the first studies to document this. So at least we know, you know, at least one thing that was, you know, reducing the population, and hopefully you guys can, you know, turn some positives from it.
Yeah, I hope so. It's been a really, really exciting study, and yeah, fun to have it out and being seen by other scientists and the public now.
MNN's Brent Palm and Tyler Garwood with the University of Minnesota. Time for our last break. More Minnesota Matters after this.
Did you know that more lives are lost to lung cancer each year than breast, colorectal, and prostate cancers combined? Lung cancer will claim more than 135,000 lives this year. But new treatments have improved survival for many with the disease and offer new hope for many more. So does lung cancer screening with low-dose chest CT. The American Cancer Society and most major professional organizations recommend that adults ages 55 and older with a long history of smoking, even if they have quit, should talk with their doctor to learn more about lung cancer screening. Lung cancer screening saves lives by detecting lung cancer early when it's more successfully treated. So, ask your doctor if lung cancer screening is right for you. And if you smoke, ask your doctor to help you quit. Visit the National Lung Cancer Roundtable website at nlcrt.org. That's nlcrt.org.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. The 7th-ranked University of Minnesota volleyball team opens its season this weekend under new head coach Keegan Cook. Eminent sports director Mike Grimm asked Cook about his first 8 months on the job, which he says were busy, busy, busy.
It just feels like it's been 3 years, honestly. Sometimes the first 6, 10 months when you take over a program can feel like that. Just how much you've done in such a short period of time, you look back and you can barely recognize where you were. So a little bit of surrealness that we're here, that we're about to play a match in the PAV, but certainly a lot of gratitude for the work that's been done by players and staff.
When you took the job, what were some things that you figured you needed to have happen to get to the point now where you're ready for this to put a team on the court that you felt good about?
Yeah, the order, and you've heard me say this a lot, was people values volleyball in that order. And people was a big deal. We had to fill some spots in the roster. We had to find a staff. I can distinctly remember being in the graduate hotel in the middle of a blizzard by myself with no staff members hired yet, thinking, oh boy, what have I done? And then I got to work. But yeah, so we solved the people problem. We've had, you know, 4 new athletes join us. You know, the number of players, you know, between both kids we've signed and verbal commitments, I think is up to 8 or 9. So a lot of work on that front and the people front. And then it was values through the spring, values through the start of this camp. And now just finally are we really starting to play the kind of volleyball that we want to play.
And you went through that, the previous visit. You've done it in other appearances at different points. But those values, just kind of give us the Cliff Notes version of what you put in terms of expectations on your players, and then just as a program, those values that you want to you know, hang your hat on, so to speak.
The two that we find ourselves talking about the most, and these are program values. I think program values come from a coach and a coaching staff. There's also team values, which we've started this week. What does this unique group of 15 people want to be held to? So we've started that process. But program values, things I was passionate about, compound interest is one. We think there's value. It's the most powerful force in the world, whether it's in retirement or in life, just small daily habits that start to snowball and work in your favor. So we've talked about that with the athletes, small thoughts, small actions that you do day after day that really direct your life. And then maybe one that would surprise people, just this idea of conflict agility. You know, how quickly can difficult moments pass through our program and get solved, and then we're on to the next one. And so those are probably the two values we spend the most time talking about, beyond maybe growth. Growth is the currency of our program. No matter where you're at when you enter, how much progress have you made over a period of time? Those three, I think, are where we find ourselves most of the time.
How do you measure what you see then in terms of where, okay, we're on track, or, oh, we need to, I don't know what the word is, clamp down, or we need to emphasize this, or how do you make sure that the train's going the right way?
Yeah, from a performance standpoint, volleyball is a highly measured analytical sport. Yep. So we're getting information every day. Every contact is statted and analyzed by a technical coordinator, and we're able to share that with athletes and say, all right, here's where we're at, here's the next standard, here's where the best teams are. So from a volleyball standpoint, constantly being data driven. I think from a value standpoint, it's just in these little moments you have to pay really close attention. You know, did a piece of difficult news make it to you in one day, or did it take three? You know, you're getting these little benchmarks of, all right, a player performed at a certain level on one day. Did she do it again the next day? So those kind of really, I don't know, nuanced observations that the coaching staff's making.
How has fall camp been? When did that start? What about, is it about a 2 week stretch here that you're in the middle of now?
Yeah, gotten a lot done, and the list remains long for what we need to get done. But you know, we've attacked it from the beginning of the rally to the end is what we say. So we've got to get the ball across the net once, and then we got to get it back. And that's how we've kind of chosen to organize things. So our side out and our serving and our out-of-system play, those three things have been our primary focus here.
And in relation to fall camp, I know you had the spring, you had the Hawaii trip, so there was chances to team build. You had two transfers then that come in. Responsiveness now where, okay, it's getting close. How has that been from the players in terms of, for some of them, it's a new coach, it's a new staff, it's a new style maybe, it's a different approach. There's probably certainly things that are similar, but I would guess things that are different too. How would you rate the responsiveness of the players?
Yeah, I met with them yesterday on this actually, and I gave them a lot of credit for their willingness to be coached, even when things feel new or the pace is faster than they're used to. Not once have I felt resistance to be coached in terms of getting feedback, and that's a huge deal. And so we spent a portion of yesterday talking about the principles behind our teaching. Why is practice at the pace that it is? Why are we team mixing so much? Why do the activities look the way they do? Try and pull back the curtain a little bit and give them a why behind the what, and that seemed to help them a little bit.
Yeah, and because obviously every coach has his or her own style. We see this in all sports where if it's a new coach, it doesn't mean – maybe it doesn't mean one style is better than the other, but Keegan Cook has his style, so it's obviously going to be different than whoever was a previous coach, whether it's Hugh McCutchen, who had success, or Mike Hebert, who was successful before him and on down the line. So how would you say, maybe from the feedback, that it is different for them? You mentioned faster pace, maybe.
Yeah, probably the tempo, you know, is a little faster. And what I told him yesterday, I said, I'm sorry that we have the people in the room that are in the room. It demands a certain level of urgency. We're not going from 14th to 12th and 12th to 10th and 10th to 8th where we have 3 years to kind of get things in place. I'm sorry you are who you are, that your talent and your skill demands that we get to work quickly. And I think I specifically said that to Kylie Murr. I get 4 months with you. I'm going to go as fast as I can before you leave us. And so I think that helped to just give them a little perspective as to why maybe things are moving as quickly as they are.
That's Gopher Volleyball Coach Keegan Cook with Eminent Sports Director Mike Grimm. For more information on Gopher Volleyball, you can go to gophersports.com. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Minnesota Matters. Be sure to join us again next week on this Eminent affiliate station, same time, same place. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Tasha Radel.